Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Dispatches. Today, we are taping in Halifax, Nova Scotia, in A Suite, which is the office of Sakyam Mepam Rinpoche, also President Ryokh, and traditionally was the office of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. I would like to welcome to the show Mr. Richard Ryokh, President of Shambhala. And we're very happy to have an opportunity to meet with Richard. We're not in an airport lounge because he's always in so many places, very ubiquitous in many different places. And Richard has had a long, illustrious career. Richard's career has been, I would say, short and meteoric. In the short time that he has actually been involved with Shambhala, he was the director of the Shambhala Center in London. He was the secretary of Sakyam Mepam Rinpoche in Europe. He was the director of the consecration, and now he is the president of Shambhala. Richard, buenos dias. Good morning.
Buenos dias to you, Julia. It's great to be here.
Richard, how did you first get involved in Shambhala altogether?
I think that I have to go back to being age 6 to answer that question, which, for those of you who are interested, is 52 years ago.
So it really was a long career.
When my parents, who were profoundly dissatisfied with sort of conventional religions, which they had dabbled in and experienced, decided to join a Japanese Buddhist community in Toronto, which is where I was born. So from age 6, when my feet couldn't actually touch the floor because we only had chairs in this center and I was swinging my feet, I began to chant Buddhist texts and to experience not just the Buddha Dharma as a series of teachings, but also as a societal or a community practice, because these were people who were reconstructing their community after being interned during the Second World War. So in that sense, I think I could say that I've attempted to practice the Buddha Dharma almost all my life. It was that which took me into my work in the field of human rights, dealing with issues of torture and extreme cruelty. And when I was about 35, I had a slipped disc, which was extremely painful, and it was that that opened the door to the practice of Tai Chi and Qigong and the martial arts. And I began reading voraciously also on those subjects. And one day, around about 1991, I was in a bookstore in London and saw a book which was titled Shambhala, The Sacred Path of the Warrior. And I read that book 3 times, which, considering I had an extraordinarily hectic job at Amnesty International, was very unusual. But I now realize the reason was that I had to get not just to the end of the book, but to the pages after the end of the book, where there was an address where you could write off to. And in those days you wrote to Boulder, and I wrote to Boulder. And about a year later, I got a reply. And they said that my letter had been sent to Germany, Germans are famed to some extent for their efficiency. So 6 months later, I got a reply from Germany telling me there was a Shambhala Center in London. And as you will well recall, Julia, I had the pleasure of coming to a level 1 in London, which you taught. And so the short answer to this question could be you are the person who brought me into Shambhala.
Oh, dear.
So in future, I'll direct all inquiries to you.
And once you entered, what happened?
I discovered how sort of physically unnerving meditation practice was. The first 2 years that I practiced, I was in constant pain, particularly in my back. I went to 2 datuns, and it was really datun practice which helped progressively dissolve that pain. In January of 1994, the Sakyong, who was then the Sawang, came to the London Shambhala Center, and I sort of renewed my refuge vows with him. Of course, I'd been taking refuge every day when I was a little boy. And I had this really interesting encounter with him. He asked me, you know, obviously who I was and, you know, where I was coming and why I was in London. And I explained that I'd grown up in a Buddhist family. And he said, ah, he said, so did I. I know the problem. So it was a very charming and sort of whimsical encounter to a person who, of course, has later almost completely taken over my life.
Tell me a little bit about how he took over your life.
Well, as he seems to work by stealth and slowly. I went to, I was very attracted to the energy of the great stupa, and I feel that it's actually through not only his writings, but through the energy of the Vidyadhara at the stupa itself that I made a profound connection with him, not perhaps on a conceptual level, but on an energetic level. And I really felt that being the director of the consecration was not just an offering, you know, to the Vidyadhara, but in some sense that there had some sense of quality of protection of that event on behalf of the lineage. But in the course of that, I was invited to, because of the work I was doing, someone asked me if I'd be the MC at a Kasong banquet. And I had joined the Dorje Kasong, but at that particular occasion I didn't have a uniform with me, I didn't know what the MC did, and as you can gather, this is my life, being asked to do things I'm not quite sure what's involved in, and just having to plunge in. So in the course of this banquet, I kept getting up making announcements, which had been pre-prepared for me, but turned out in each case to be wrong. And I kept getting up over and over and coming to the microphone, in the end knowing that I was bound to be saying something that was incorrect, such as where the dinner plates actually are or whether the salad is being served now or not. And in the course of that, David, the Sakyong called David Brown, his secretary, over, and as I now know, said to him, "We need a secretary in Europe, don't we?" And David said yes. And the Sakyong gestured to this fellow who was constantly getting up, giving incorrect information, and said, "Let's ask him." So that is how I came closer into his service. But I couldn't say that I had a close personal relationship with the Sakyong, and that might surprise some people given the position I hold now. The secretary enables other people to meet the Sakyong and have that kind of engagement, and I really saw that one was what you could say, like a conduit or literally a servant who enables him to encounter others rather than being in a person, sort of a personal position. And the same really was true of the consecration. I actually had three meetings only with him over the course of what was a two-year period of work. One at the beginning to be clear what needed to be done. I went away and did it. Once to clarify what would be on the shrine, and then when he actually came to Shambhala Mountain Center. So I wasn't one of those who went golfing with him, drinking with him, or watching The Sopranos with him. So probably nobody was more surprised than I when he phoned me in September of 2002 and said that he was considering appointing a president and that my name had come up.
Could you say a little bit about the continuity that there seems to be in your life, just hearing you speak now, between having been the head of communications for Amnesty International, being comfortable giving the wrong information at a Kasong banquet, and in many, many, many ways, creating a style of communication that seems to have a lot to do with how you actually manage communication, which seems to be the style of communication that we have in the Sangha today, very professional. The website is extraordinarily beautiful and well-designed, probably slick, for lack of a better word. Do you see some kind of thread there and how you may have been chosen to be president because of some of those qualities themselves?
Well, I've never thought of it that way, actually, so that's why I paused. Actually, First of all, I think it has more to do with being uncomfortable than being comfortable. The absolute thing I was not during that cosmic banquet, for example, was comfortable. Because from the first announcement I made, every single moment after that, I knew that someone in uniform was going to come over and tell me that what I'd said was wrong. And I remember that the costume who was sitting next to me, someone who I had never met before, turned to me at a certain point and said, "Boy, you must inhabit the realm of no thought." And an early experience of people projecting things onto me. And I just turned to her and said, "I suggest you eat your dinner." And in all my experience of working in Amnesty International was one of profound discomfort. First of all, because of the nature of the material we were dealing with, you know, the constant tide of information about people being arrested, people at risk of torture, people at risk of execution, working with the fact that no matter how hard one tried, one had to find any measure of dignity in the effort rather than necessarily depending on the results. And when I was in heading up Amnesty's communications, I mean, we were constantly under attack. I mean, I think a lot of people think of Amnesty as a noble organization, which indeed it is, but often don't realize how at the heart of it it's so profoundly controversial, because you're taking on some of the most deeply vested interests in the world, which are also extremely nasty. So, you know, I received death threats personally, you know, for the work that I did. And I would describe being the president as profoundly uncomfortable. So actually I see this continuity of some being in situations which are deeply challenging, which are extraordinarily stretching, and offer no respite as being the continuity. And I'm pleased you like the website. In the early discussions about the new website, there was a lot of discussion about what the defining image should be on the website. And all those discussions inevitably led to people saying, "Well, Shambhala isn't this, Shambhala isn't that. You think Shambhala is this, you think Shambhala is that." And I suggested this approach, which I personally feel has worked, of getting as many possible images showing the range of our community, the range of practices, our history, this kind of slideshow effect which goes through it, so that you begin to see the diversity, I mean the incredible richness of what Shambhala has to offer, rather than attempting to narrow it down. And I think that sometimes, you know, the narrowing down is always the search for something that will make us comfortable in the midst of the vastness. And I maybe in some interesting way my life has helped me rest a little bit with the broadness.
The image that I get is a giant charnel ground and different posts in the middle of this charnel ground, and a charnel ground that's actually controversial.
Yeah.
And it seems like the broadness of imagery in the website is a way to have the various aspects of the controversy have their own inherent seat. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there is a phase that I would imagine is very necessary in the continuity and establishment of, in the political sense, of regime, in the spiritual sense, a lineage and a church, for lack of a better word, that is by nature narrowing. For example, who is your teacher? Having been in many seminaries, I remember from the 92 seminary on to the 99 seminary on to, for example, 2004, that the conception of how you actually ask the question, "Will you be my teacher?" Became a less sort of potpourri of, yes, you can have five teachers and me too. Down to, you have to take the Sakyong as your teacher if you're going to enter, particularly the Shambhala Nungdro. So how do you work with both the sense of having a very large tent, as the Sakyong talks, and which is what the website actually presents, and a thread through which you must actually put your prajna through in order to bead a path with the Sakyong.
You know, actually, I don't think those are remotely contradictory, and I think you've actually just described very beautifully what Shambhala is and has to offer. And oddly enough, what it reminds me of, although you're speaking of it in terms of, you know, our particular practice, was an interview that I read with the president of Columbia University a couple of years ago in the back of Time magazine when he was talking about the graduation of the class of 9/11. Those students who had come into university in the same month, literally, as the destruction of the World Trade Center, and those who were now graduating. And what he was essentially saying was that what humanity faces at this present time is a choice between closed mind and open mind. And that the effect of fear had been to close down the spirit of intellectual inquiry on the part of those who were entering university. That there was less sense of looking into difficult issues and difficult questions. That whereas traditionally education had been about taking people to uncomfortable places, now what the students were showing in their sort of questionnaires and feedback was more of a kind of clubbing together or group mentality, where what they appreciated was other people thinking the same as them. And this was how, and they were starting to rate the value of their educational experience in terms of the extent to which it promoted a sense of comfort, uniformity, and clubbing together. And he said, to that extent, we can say that the terrorists have won. Now, the point here is that what does a profound spiritual path offer? A closed mind or an open mind? My experience of this journey is one where the mind, and in this sense I'm using mind to mean both mind and heart, open wider and wider and wider to an extent that is unimaginable at the beginning of the process. And what is the method by which one gets there? Part of that method is by, obviously, what we would call exertion, discipline, all those things. And one needs a guide in that. And I know this from my experience in studying Qigong. I have seen many people who take what I guess the Vidyadhara would have called, or others would have called, a cafeteria approach to these things. But I happen to be someone who has stuck with one master for 20 years. And it is through the, again, the discomfort of that relationship, of being willing to serve one teacher who will work with whatever energetic or physical or personal obscurations you have. So that, for example, in the case of my Qigong master, he showed me a fundamental correction of my posture after 11 years that I'd been studying with him. Because I guess at that point he thought, well, at this point he might actually be able to do that. And so I think that the relationship here with the teacher is about how one actually navigates the path to an extraordinarily open and vast mind. And that's not the same, as I would understand, as a process of narrowing down. Of course, it's a choice. But actually, all spiritual paths, in some level, require that choice, just in the same way that one has to make that fundamental choice in terms of what education means.
In that systole of opening and closing, if one manages to process it properly, it can be transformed to path. But if one doesn't, it could transform itself into despair and profound disaffection.
Of course.
And it seems to me that the key element between one and the other, on a personal basis, is confidence. On a relationship basis, it's trust. If you can't trust, how can you go forward?
Well, I think that comes again to the question of what trust is. And that's really interesting. It goes back to what seems to be the theme here, because if what you trust in and what you have confidence in is what you're already comfortable with, what you've already learned, what you already expect, and what you already want, then you're actually not able, you know, the traditional analogy in the Buddhist teachings, it's the cup that is already full, or the cup that is turned over and cannot receive the teachings. And so it's, I think, you know, we're all learning this, you know, this whole tradition is being transplanted, and we're the first generations that are working with that. And I was so struck when Jigme Rinpoche, the brother-in-law of the Sakyong now, spoke last year to the Acharyas. He began, actually, talking to them about a teaching on trustworthiness from the Vidyadhara that he had been reading. And he went on to say that in the Tibetan tradition, the trustworthiness of a teacher is defined as a teacher who is capable of guiding a person on the spiritual path without any personal contact. And of course, that's a profoundly, profoundly unsettling concept to us. And what that ultimately, in my understanding at this point, rests on is the extent to which one is able, in a sense, in the discomfort of one's practice, to connect with the energetic mind of the teacher. And, you know, in a profoundly materialist age, and also in the age where people often think that help will come by going physically into the room with a therapist, etc., this is a deeply challenging way of understanding confidence and trust.
But taking that further, wouldn't you say that the difference between the Sutrayana paths and the Vajrayana paths is exactly the nature of that relationship between teacher-student, and that all devotion is love and trust, and all blessings arise from the mutuality of that devotion and trust between teacher-student? And how can that be realized in a world where conceptually there is also no surrender?
Well, obviously, it's a very, very personal journey. And you would be the last person to think that I could tell other people how that works out. But I can only speak of my own experience, perhaps in two ways. I remember that about a year after I was appointed, the Sakyong was coming to Karma Choling, and I was there, and he was staying at, you know, in one place, I was staying in another. And of course, you know, being surrounded by, you know, sort of an inconceivable list of problems that had fallen on my plate, I thought he would probably want to check up with me and perhaps put some more problems on my plate. I was hesitant to check in with him because I've just felt so keenly that that the best offering one can give to him is a spacious environment in which he can do what he does best. So we actually hadn't spoken to each other for 3 days, and then I started to get nervous. You know, it's almost like a game of chicken, except obviously he wasn't playing it. And I met him at the entrance to the shrine room, sort of, I think, on the second last day that he was there, and said quietly, you know, perhaps I should call you. And he looked at me and he said, "I'm always calling you." And this wasn't a quip. This was something on which I reflected a lot. What does that mean? Does it mean that I have a preconceived view of what this relationship is, and that he's inviting me to a different kind of relationship? Subsequently, in the next period, I had a long phase when I used to wake up in the mornings, feeling that I was lying at the bottom of the ocean, and that miles of water were above me. And my practice in that period was just to lie there, in the bed, and feel this unbearable pressure. And almost with some sense that if I were to do anything like what we would call conventional practice or get up and do my qigong or something, that would be somehow using those things as a distraction from what I was experiencing. And of course I found, as anyone would in that situation, that after a while that sensation dissolves. And then I tended to find that if I then just then lay there in that sense of dissolution, that ideas and messages would come into my mind that would guide me on what needed to be done. And I was absolutely confident by the nature of those messages, which, you know, on one level were extraordinarily ordinary, but were absolutely not the process of my thinking, that was the relationship of him calling me.
So in terms of your relationship to the Sakyong, him calling you and you calling him seems to create the blessings which you are then to communicate to others and to be almost a portal for the Sakyong's mind, a portal through which people can enter the Sakyong's mind and a portal through which people can hear the Sakyong's wisdom and beckoning.
Well, the only thing I wanted to say there, you're looking at me as if that's, you know, me, Richard Ryok, who's that. I would say that is the experience which I believe is available to and which countless practitioners also experience, in the same way that, you know, so many of the long-term practitioners of the Vidyadhara still have a completely living relationship with his mind through dreams, through visions, and in other ordinary ways. And which you can feel actually in this room.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to be clear in case anybody thinks that you were describing something that's unique to me.
Well, but you are the president.
Yes.
And that puts you in a very, you are the dot. And in relationship to dots and a dot, as far as our government or such, how... not necessarily decentralized, because we do have a decentralized government structure, but how empowered are the various layers of governance that work directly with you? How are they?
This word empowerment is a really, really interesting word that I've been exploring, and obviously a lot of others have been exploring as well. And to try and understand really what does it come from, and how can you notice if someone is empowered or not? Because, you know, just from a very obvious level, two people can have the same title. One can feel empowered, the other cannot feel empowered. For example, two center directors. One can feel empowered and other people think they're empowered. One can feel they're empowered and other people don't think they're empowered. I mean, it's a very, very fascinating mix to look at here. And obviously the goal here, the vast vision of Shambhala is that actually every practitioner should be able to see the Sakyong and Sakyong Wangmo qualities in themselves and radiate that out. And I think some people think, well, you know, that's a neat piece of poetry or some sort of poetic expression. But that is obviously what our lineage is determined to have happen. So in that, following that guidance, then it's really important that a sense of empowerment, which after all means really having the genuine ability to serve others, is something which is experienced at every level of the mandala. And you know, I think if anything, that's probably the one thing that I'm constantly trying to work with others to figure out how to do. Because if we take some very simple things, you know, people get confused, obviously, about the notion of natural hierarchy. What does that actually mean? What does it actually mean to have a seat? What is the difference between influence and authority? What is the difference between authority and empowerment? And as I work more and more on these things, It's really, I see we almost have to go through almost like a vocabulary exercise to start to understand how all these different ideas work together. And particularly as we make the process of manifesting Shambhala increasingly, I hope, participatory, people then even get confused about the meaning of the word democratic. Then they get confused about, are we being consulted? Are we making decisions? And at that point, there's a real nothing special in that sense about the issues we're talking through in Shambhala, because these are fundamental organizational issues that a lot of organizations are now working on, which is how to be clear about what one is doing and who has the authority to do what, while at the same time getting maximum level of engagement and participation from people.
So who has the authority to do what?
Well, I think that is getting much clearer in the sense that we have a document, for example, that was adopted after the first Shambhala Congress called the Tenets of Shambhala Governance. It's up on the website, and center directors have it, which have started to say, you know, what is the authority of the Sakyong? What is the authority of the Sakyong's Council? What is the authority of the Mandala Council? What does the Congress do? And obviously that's a work in progress. And then really what I'm hoping and is starting to happen at many centers is that people are starting to go, okay, we now need to be clear. What does the governing council of the center do? What does the executive director do? What do the heads of the various departments do? And, you know, this is really, I would say, a very exciting and indeed fertile phase at the moment. And you see a lot of centers are experimenting with different ways of understanding this. And I'm so pleased to see that it's experimental, because I really am not in favor of having one single blueprint here, because at the very least, we have to remember we're global. And the way these issues will work out in parts of Asia, in places more remote from the center, like New Zealand or Latin America, you know, one has to bring in different cultural traditions. Okay. So the question here is how to get to the essence and allow for maximum diversity.
And when you reflect upon your career, both in Amnesty International and now as president of Shambhala, what would you say are the main differences between running an NGO and running a church or a lineage, spiritual lineage?
I think one of the interesting differences is the motivation of people coming in is different. Many, many people come to a spiritual tradition because they're in deep pain in a personal way, whereas other people come to an organization to sign up for some, you know, collective objective like saving the planet or saving the whales or whatever. Actually their orientation is different, the way you organize them is different, and the way you measure and get results is different. But a spiritual path is very, very different. And what is on offer is a much deeper level of personal challenge, a much deeper level of personal transformation than can ever be accomplished through simply many hands on deck trying to solve a problem. Now, the second thing is, and I've seen this in obviously my own experience, but in I know from many organizations, many of these non-governmental organizations are in a period of crisis now because of the problems of burnout, the problems of despair, the problems of internal aggression. Because it's almost as if you don't have some contemplative practice as a foundation or as a partner in that work, then the daily swimming in blood or swimming in poison ends up poisoning the workers, and it ends up poisoning the relationships of the workers among themselves. And so there's a tremendous search on now in the sort of activist community for the kind of spiritual practices that help people purify that, understand its nature, and be able to work in a sustained way. Now, those are the practices that are cultivated and are at the heart of a community like Shambhala. And recently, what is so interesting is how people, many people in Shambhala now are talking about how can the richness that we have be offered in a way that actually transforms the nature of this kind of global activism. So, for example, at the recent Congress, when arising out of recommendations that came from the Halifax Shambhala Center and the St. Margaret's Bay Center, when they were preparing for the Congress, there was a whole discussion of how we contribute to the protection of the planet in this era when the planet is under threat from apparently so much, you know, human activity. And the warrior general made a wonderful presentation about not only do we have, in a sense, the person power that can contribute to, green activity, but there is a way of understanding how to work with these issues and a way of understanding how to work with our minds so that we might actually be able to offer some practical ways in which the search for a better future doesn't end up just being yet another war between people who would like others to think the same way that they do.
You know, for me, the acid test of all of this is the courage to give up all hope of fruition. Which is unheard of in the traditional world.
Well, it's certainly it's certainly true in my experience. You know, I'm quite heavily involved in attempting to support the peace process in Sri Lanka, a country which has the Buddhist world's longest-running war. And what I see so clearly is that those whose eyes are fixated 5 years ahead, because now we're entering a very, very difficult period in that situation where probably there will be a long phase of further fighting. Those who are, in a sense, obsessively fixated on peace are not capable of listening to the inner reality of those who are currently committed to fighting. And you can't actually move forward without that willingness to immerse yourself in that listening and also that discomfort.
We're going to take a short break and we will be right back.
There's so much dreck on the internet these days, so much slime and muck of the dark age. Isn't it great to have something like the Chronicles of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche to provide relief? This is Barry Boyce, senior editor of Shambhala Sun magazine and Buddha Dharma magazine. This is membership month at the Chronicles site, and the Chronicles is supported by its members. So if you want to hear and see more of the great Dharma and discussion on this site, please join. It's $9 a month, or more if you like. If you join this month, you'll receive a print of the Barbara Bash calligraphy, Born a Monk, Died a King, especially executed for the 20-year commemoration of Trungpa Rinpoche's Parinirvana. Just click on Support This Work, the last item in the left-hand menu on any page. So, if you're tired of the dreck and you still aspire to see the Guru's face, become a Chronicles member. Thanks.
We are back in A Suite talking to President Richard Ryok. Richard, when did you start wearing narrow suits?
A long time ago. In 1971, I first went to India, and that's the first place that actually Amnesty International sent me to work. I worked in India and South Asia for 5 years. At a certain point, I calculated that I'd traveled in 18 months more than the distance around the equator on Indian third-class trains. And so I've always had a strong and abiding connection with India. And interestingly, when the Sakyong asked me to help him as president, I was working with the Indian National Human Rights Commission and the British Council on a fascinating project of training the most senior police in India on questions to do with the prevention of torture. And India is part of my life. I feel comfortable this way, and Marty Janovitz once said that we should take up a collection to get me some lapels. And
buy you a tie.
I'd like to reassure everybody, I actually do have some suits, and I occasionally do appear in a suit and tie. But I was really struck, actually, on this last trip. I was in India with the Sakyong, and of course went to the wedding festival in Orissa, but more importantly went on a pilgrimage, you know, to the great Buddhist sites, many of the great Buddhist sites in India. And, you know, it's so energetically touching to know that that is where the first footsteps of the Buddha left their imprint on the soil of the planet, and I have a very deep affection for that fact, in addition to the fact that it was India which opened its arms to receive the Tibetans when they were in flight.
In terms of the many ways of walking the path, there are many very, very good teachers that are both in India and in Nepal and all over the world and in North America. And we these days belong to a community that actually partakes of that very fortunate karmic coincidence that we can receive teachings from many different teachers besides Sakyamipa Rinpoche. And it may have become a somewhat controversial issue in some of our centers that there is a sense of enormous gratitude that we have had such a broad, inviting approach to many different teachers, but at the same time, there is more recently a sense that in order to have there be more cohesion in the curriculum and in the offerings, that that is being managed more tightly. Can you comment on that?
Sure. The Sakyong has been really clear about this, I think, on many fronts, which relates not just to, you know, teachers, but also to curriculum and how we understand ourselves. And what he's been saying is that particularly once he had the inspiration to develop the Shambhala Nyendro and work on that as well as the post-Vajrayana path as the stepping stone to the Scorpion Seal Retreat, the most precious in a sense of the mind terma of the Vidyadhara, that in the sort of, whatever you want to call it, the mall of offerings of teachings, which of course is constantly expanding, both in terms of books and numbers of Buddhist centers, that people need to know, well, what is it that you get when you come to Shambhala? What is the path? What are the offerings? What are the practices? Where does it lead? And who are the teachers that offer that? And I think you can see that there's a lot of work going on now on a lot of fronts to try and do that. And as you quite rightly said, the challenge is how, on the one hand, to be clear about that so that we're a little bit less confusing than some people find us, and at the same time not to become, you know, kind of dogmatic. So that's how I understand this. I was just involved in discussions in this office just the other day about, you know, how we shape some guidance now for everybody on this. And just an example here would be that, you know, we're now a community as opposed to the way we were, say, maybe 5 years ago, if I'm right, where we have almost 40 acharyas. 40 acharyas who, between them, have had, you know, the direct experience of the teachings and transmissions of the Vidyadhara, of the Sakyong, and many of whom have actually shaped Shambhala training and all that sort of thing. And so it's clear that the Sakyong would like to feel that people who want to take refuge in bodhisattva vows in our community take them with those people, so that there is a sense of I think the word here is cohesion. And I think there's a reason for this cohesion, which seems important to me at any rate, because, you know, we're not just teaching meditation. We are not just a sort of university with different faculties where you could take an interest in Kyudo or Ikebana, and nor are we offering a sort of a path of personal salvation. The Vijayadara's vision, and that's the vision of our lineage, is to create, in whatever form that will take, something that we call enlightened society, and which we put on as its name, Kingdom of Shambhala. And that involves the development of a society. It involves the sense that we're not just of course, we can inviting to people who come in and wish to leave and partake of the richness. But those who would like to build that have to kind of work together to do that. And it's interesting how that's so much in the mind I see of the Sakyong. For example, one of the first things he suggested to me after I became president was that we should stop talking about Shambhala International. And we should be talking about Shambhala, understanding Shambhala to be the outer name of the inner name, Kingdom of Shambhala. So I think there is, obviously everybody knows there's a social vision and a societal vision, and for that there has to be some sense of building a community. And I think that's part of what's being looked at here.
And how do we accommodate those who define themselves as hardcore Kagyu, or hardcore Nyingma, or hardcore Kagyu Nyingma? Where do they fit in our great society and our great community?
Well, I'm happy to tell you that a document which has been being worked on, you know, with Carolyn Mendelker in the Office of Practice and Education and a number of our more senior acharyas and directly with the Sakyong, I was having a conversation about this the other day. It may actually be ready after one more round of consultation to be available after this year's Vajrayana Seminary. And what it sets out is the rather daunting richness, I may say so, of how all these strands in the tapestry fit together and are mutually reinforcing in the phase which leads from receiving transmission at the Vajrayana Seminary through to entering into the Scorpion Seal Retreat. I don't pretend to understand all the complexities about this. I have to be, as Clint Eastwood said, a man's got to know his limitations. But I have been really trying to encourage this process so that those who really want to go in and delve into this and the complexities of how this fits together and begin to see this as a tapestry in which you can clearly see, oh, there are the, you know, there are the yellow threads, there are the red threads, there are the blue threads, there are the white threads, and then see, oh, how does that incredible richness, which seems to be one of the things that really distinguishes the power of Shambhala, how does all that work together? And actually, I like the fact that it's taken a long time to work on that, because this could not simply be a cheap matter to be sorted out on one piece of paper, you know.
In some of our internal and external communications, we talk about how we are a community of 8,000 households, mm-hmm. I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious how we measure that, how we come up with that number, whether it's how many people are in a mailing list or so on, and how many of those people would have the capacity to redefine themselves within that systole of narrowing and expanding without becoming disheartened and confused. So it's a two-part question. How do we measure the total community, and what kind of expectations we have about people being able to digest and rekindle and reconnect themselves to the main line, so to speak, the center of the mandala and the periphery?
Yeah. Well, let's take this fascinating question of how large is Shambhala, you know? I guess a lot of people wouldn't know this, and probably most people wouldn't care, but one of the challenges that that we face as an organization is that we don't actually know who our members are. And this really goes back to a long period which we have lived through and come through, where there was such considerable fragmentation that many centers were left, in a sense, on their own to develop their own way forward, and so they have their own systems and that kind of thing. And it's one of our small, sort of unseen but huge tasks is creating an integrated database for the whole of Shambhala, so that we at the very least can know who are on our mailing lists, who, so that we can ensure there isn't duplication, all these very mundane things, but more importantly, so that we can start actually sending information out about programming to the people who actually need to receive it, as opposed to doing it on a kind of guesswork basis. So at the moment, this figure of the 8,000 households is basically our best guess using all the information that's provided to us by centers. And it includes friends of Shambhala, people who are on mailing lists, people who are members. So it's a way of describing the sort of the knowable universe at the moment.
So Shambhalas and Shambhala in-laws.
Sort of, but what it leaves out, of course, and that's perhaps even more important, is the vast number of people who every month are going online and searching on Google or other search organs for Shambhala. That that is probably in a month is larger than the total number of people that we think we have in the organization. And I think that speaks, you know, to a much vaster vision of Shambhala, not in terms of Shambhala as an organization, but in terms of Shambhala as a human archetype. This profound conviction that I would say every human being has, that there's a better way of going about things in terms of our relations with each other and our relationships with the globe. And this word Shambhala comes up in the consciousness, and they search for it. It may not be that they search for it in the sense of wanting to belong to it, but they want to find it. And so part of our challenge, and that goes back to your earlier question about communication, is not simply to provide a website and a portal for teachings for people who've already made a strong connection, but actually how can we get to the point where we're more of a beacon for much larger numbers of people. Now that, it seems to me, goes to the heart of the second part of your question, which I think has to do with this openness. You know, I think sometimes we think that the only true, you know, kind of Shambhala person, you know, card-carrying member of Shambhala is someone who is being catapulted forward on some kind of linear path, which brings with it all the problems of people not actually settling into the practices that they receive, thinking that they've got to get to the next program, and the risk of people thinking that this is a linear path. Whereas my understanding is that what we're attempting to do is to say, well, someone comes into a local center. First of all, they should experience an atmosphere there, an atmosphere that they do not experience in some sense elsewhere, because it is really soaked in the teachings and the practices that go on there. And then they'll be attracted to something that resonates with their karma. And for that person, it might be, for example, calligraphy. And if that becomes that person's path for this lifetime, that we should do everything possible to support that and enrich it. And that then also applies, you know, to people who may decide that they want to go further. And then you referred to, you know, hardcore practitioners. I guess you probably meant soft core, because the goal of the practices is to soften. But if people are attracted to a particular form of ritual, a particular form of visualization, and are able to see that as their way forward in understanding the true nature of their mind and the true nature of phenomena, then we have to be a community that is able to be profoundly supportive of that, including those who for a period of time decide that they don't want to have anything to do with Shambhala, that Shambhala was a path, or maybe you could say a vehicle or a raft, that took them a certain part of the way on their journey, and then they decided to carry on that journey in another way. And I am totally against either demonizing those people or running after them, as I sometimes see people obsessively, as if there's a betrayal or a loss going on. Because, you know, I think if you take a very, very, very long view of this, I always come back to this great moment in a teaching that Khandro Rinpoche gave when she asked at a program, how many of you are new to Shambhala? And a lot of hands went up, and she said, you're all wrong. You couldn't actually be at this teaching if you hadn't been in Shambhala for lifetimes.
To end our interview, Richard, I wanted to ask about the future. Hmm. How is this lineage to be continued? Through a father-son type of lineage, or is it a tulku lineage, or is it a student-teacher? Hmm. And how does the Repa family figure in all of this? Because it takes two to tango and make babies if it goes that direction.
Yes. Well, first of all, the Sakyong has been very clear that this is, in the Tibetan terms, what is called a dunjud, or family lineage. And I was struck by this long before he said it, on the first and only trip I've made so far to the Sirmong Valley, when we went around to visit the valley, the 14 villages in the valley. At one of them, of course, there was the ritual welcoming, and an old gentleman got up and described how he had received a letter many, many years ago from Trungpa Rinpoche, saying that that this lineage was being passed down through through his family, and that one day his son, you know, would come to this valley and inherit that lineage. And it was a very touching moment as this very old gentleman spoke those words with tears running down his eyes. So in the terms of that, then the question is that there have to be children. And as everybody knows, it wasn't quite clear how that was going to come about. It was a couple of years ago, and the Sakyong actually discussed with me, I'm sure with others, saying, you know, I've got to get married. And that's part of his fulfillment of that. And now we've had this extraordinary karmic confluence, which brings together not only a person who can be the new Sakyong Wangmo, and therefore supply the other essential ingredient for the lineage to continue in that way, but more powerfully, this connection from the teaching point of view between that family and the Mukpo family. I think everybody knows that of the extraordinarily close, indeed I think it's fair to say profound connection between Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche and Namgyal Drimay Rinpoche when they were very, very young in Tibet.
It's the father-in-law.
Yes, indeed. And that what we're going to see increasingly is what I like to think of as a confluence. Think of two rivers or two mountain streams coming out of the Himalayas, and they come together. And I was very touched only a couple of weeks ago, the Sakyong who had been in retreat in the Maritika cave where Padmasambhava and Princess Mandarava practiced many centuries ago, he and Namgyal Drimay Rinpoche were practicing together. Khandro La was there as well. And at a certain point, Namgyal Drimay Rinpoche said to the Sakyong, in one of those timeless statements which sort of defies generational logic, "I've been waiting to meet you all my life." So I think that at this very deep level, the future of the lineage is secured. My understanding from answers I've heard that the Sakyong has given, that it's not necessarily male specific, and it's probably not even necessarily dependent on order of precedence in children, but as another tulku said recently, it'll be quite a challenge for them even to keep their first child, because the entire Tibetan world is watching to see what the confluence of these two lineages results in terms of a living manifestation of enlightened mind.
And just one further question on that same question. What happens if he/she heir to the kingdom of Shambhala runs into the Japanese scientist on Citadel Hill? The Japanese scientist being Trungpa Rinpoche's perplexing remark about the nature of his rebirth.
Well, obviously, you know, I can't predict the future, but A, I would love to be there, and B, I can't imagine it would be anything but tears running down the cheeks of both of them.
Richard, I want to thank you for all your time and your candidness and your willingness to talk to us in dispatches today. But much more profoundly, thank you for helping Sakyong Mipon Rinpoche bring about the world that he would like to bring forward in a way to meet the wish of his father and the wish of the many, 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 many beings that actually give blessings to this community. Thank you very much for your ubiquitousness, for your willingness to communicate what the Sakyong beckons you about, and for your apparently inexhaustible patience putting up with the aggression that comes your way. Perhaps with good intention of trying to communicate, but as in the days of amnesty, it's not an easy job.
And Huli, I need to thank you for teaching me level one, and to thank you for what you're doing for the Chronicles, and also to the Chronicles people who are here, because this is, I feel it's taken on a new lease of life, and I love listening, and thank you so much for what you're doing.
Besos.